So Federico's been really advocating the for the advantages of the Irish system, and I'm going to take a slightly different approach and talk about the advantages and the innovations which have been introduced in my area, in commercial law and corporate law, in the last number of years, and why really the UK has been leading the charge in this area, and why I'm suggesting that it's going to continue to do that in many ways. So the first slide indicates for you just a number of regulatory innovations which have been introduced in my field. And it's where British lawmakers or policymakers or courts have been involved in developing new ideas, new approaches, new products, and new doctrines. And these have been followed not just at national level, but at supranational level. And I'm going to focus on four of these innovations and just explain how they developed. So I'm not going to get into the substantive law, don't worry, but just to explain how they've developed and why it's relevant to the continuing relevance of the UK. So I would argue that the UK will be continuing its impact and influence on Irish law reform, particularly in these three areas. So if you have a situation where there is no EU dimension, then English law is likely to be influential, and Irish law is likely to continue to track it. If there is an area where an EU dimension, English law will still be influential. Why? Because it will have had an impact, certainly in my area, it will have had an impact in the EU law as it develops, and so its continued relevance there. And then finally, to the extent that whatever EU legislation is introduced is minimum harmonisation, or where there are provisions for opt-outs or discretions for member states, in those circumstances, again, I think English law will continue to be the go-to for the Irish legislature. So in these three ways, so looking at the four examples now, I'm going to explain how English law has had an impact on Irish law in these two ways, or in EU law. So the first example relates to the regulation of takeovers. And takeovers were a feature of the UK environment since the 1950s. Takeover contests for British companies led to the boards of those companies try and frustrate bids and introduce defensive tactics. Shareholders obviously annoyed that they were deprived of an opportunity to accept bids, suggested that something needed to be done about this. Was it legislation? Was it not? There was an attempt at introducing guidelines which didn't work. Shareholder litigation increased, and as a result, the committee stepped in 1968 and established the UK Takeover Panel, which is a self-regulatory oversight body overseeing the conduct of takeovers. And they introduced at the same time a city code. And this city code establishes the rules of conduct for bidders and targets in a takeover of the listed company. And for a number of years, because the stock exchanges in the UK and Ireland were jointly operated and run as a single company, the UK panel regulated us and did a spectacularly good job in doing that. EU law actually intervened in the sense that the Investment Services Directive suggested that there should be a national regulator, and therefore the stock exchanges split, and the UK panel said, really, this was the time for us to establish our own panel. So, an area where at the time there was no EU dimension, so what happened? We looked to our nearest neighbour. For various reasons, it wasn't possible to introduce a self-regulatory system, so a statutory system was introduced, and the legislation set out there applied, the 1997 Takeover Panel Act. It was based very much on takeover regulation in the UK, and you can see that by looking at some of the provisions in it relating to things like mandatory bids, a prohibition on frustrating action, and treatment of concert parties, so very much based on the UK system. The rules which were introduced were a direct, I was going to say copy, but really plagiarism is a better word to use. So the rules in number even tracked their UK counterparts. It used to be called the Blue Book, small Blue Book. We put a green cover in ours. But largely, the rules were very similar. So it was very influential in that respect. When it came then to talking about a UK directive, the obvious place to look at was what had been happening in the UK, because they had the largest market, they had more experience. And so the provisions which had been introduced in the UK found their way into the Takeovers Directive. Now, this wasn't surprising, because by the time the Takeovers Directive had been introduced, the good example set by the UK panel and the rules they had been introduced had already found their way into different jurisdictions. So it wasn't just Ireland. You could see similar rules applying in countries such as Sweden and Austria. The negotiation of the directive was really, really hard. It took 21 years from the introduction of a white paper to actually get it across a line. So in terms of Brexit negotiations, it makes the last 2 years look really like a walk in the park. Because it was so difficult, there was a lot of compromise involved in it. There was a lot of opt-out provisions. There was a lot of discretion afforded, and it was a minimum harmonization. So in those areas, the UK tracked, or Ireland tracked the UK approach and applied the same provisions. The second area, and I'll just mention this briefly to give a shout out to the Law Reform's recent paper, the DPAs, Divert Prosecution Agreements, they were introduced in the UK in 2013. They'd been around in the States, as many of you will know, since the 1990s, but they really were a different animal. The UK DPA involved an agreement to suspend prosecution once the company applied certain conditions. The fact that it was only available to a company rather than to an individual was one distinction between the UK and American system. It was also court supervised, which made it particularly attractive. The court would only approve the DPA if it's in the interests of justice and if the terms are fair, reasonable, and proportionate. There have been a number introduced already, not a huge number, four or five have been introduced in the UK relating to areas like false accounting and conspiracy. But they have been very successful, and they've been followed, as you can see on the slide, in a number of jurisdictions, including France, so not just the common law jurisdictions. Australia is currently looking at it, and it's likely to be introduced in the next couple of months. So in this area where there was no EU dimension as such, where did we look? Yes, we looked, and you can see that in the really excellent description in the Law Reform paper of the differences between the US-UK system, but we looked primarily to the UK for that. A third is scheme of arrangement. So these are undertakings between a company and its creditors or shareholders. And they've been very popular in the UK. They've been in the UK since 1985. They've been used as a process to allow companies restructure without having to enter insolvency proceedings. So really popular in the UK, and not just for UK companies. They've been popular for non-UK companies, for unregistered companies, which have been accessing the UK to take advantage of them. Why? Because there's experience in the UK, their judges are used to it, it's backed by a very strong system of case law. They've been very successful. They've been followed. We have one, as many of you know, in our Companies Act. They've also been followed in the Netherlands and Cyprus. This is one of the areas where the UK lawyers are concerned that other people are going to take their cake. And I think that's exactly how they will view this. And there's been excessive lobbying of the UK authorities to do something about this from the UK bar, from the English bar. It's also an area where it's changed or could change EU law. So there is no scheme in EU law at the moment, but there certainly were discussions, and this is one of the points I wanted to stress from this presentation. I was part of an EU Commission group looking at reforming the area of cross-border mergers and divisions and conversions. And one of the areas we were specifically asked to look at as an advisory group, so not a lawmaking group, but as an advisory group, was the area of schemes and whether this is something that could translate into EU law. Working with me on that committee was somebody from the Netherlands and somebody from the UK. So that experience, that expertise was on the panel. And in a case like that, it was on the panel by invitation only. So is that expertise going to continue? I'll come back to that in a moment. The last area, as you all know, is the comply or explain. So in the UK, the first corporate governance code was introduced in 1992, and the Cadbury Code, imposing certain best practice standards for directors of listed companies. And it was applied on a comply or explain. So it's not mandatory. What you must do is say whether you comply, and if you don't comply, if you don't comply, I think that means it's coffee time. If you don't, thank you. If you don't comply, you need to explain why not. So this whole approach was, again, adopted in Ireland, applied through our listing rules with an Irish annex, an Irish tweak, but the same code as it developed in the UK. And interestingly, it found its way into EU law. So you can see it in the Statutory Audits Directive, and you can see it later in the Shareholders' Rights Directive. Okay, so this brings us to the question, why has English law been so influential in these various areas? And there are a number of possible rationales, and I don't pretend that this is exhaustive, but just a number of things to think about. So the first, the theoretical argument. So 20 years ago this year, Rafael Laporta and some of his colleagues in the University of Harvard in Chicago produced a seminal paper in the area of law and finance. And they established a connection between legal tradition and minority shareholder protection on one hand, and then the growth of capital markets and financial development on the other hand. And they said that the Anglo-Irish system was the most efficient system for protecting the rights of shareholders and minority protection. And despite a number of quibbles about the methodologies used, that has been the primary approach by the law and finance to looking at different traditions and looking at transplantation of the different common law and civil law systems. There's also, of course, a legal perspective on this. And the legal perspective suggests, well, you look at convergence and you see, well, what causes country laws, national laws, to converge or diverge? And there you look at, well, what winning characteristics are there in place? So you might have convergence through transplantation, and that's likely to be the case if you have things in common. So if you have compatibility of the firm structure, if you have compatibility of the law generally, if you have compatibility of the macroeconomic conditions. And of course, that compatibility exists between the UK and Ireland, which makes us ripe for convergence in that way. There's also a possibility of convergence through harmonisation of norms. And we're seeing that, of course. That's the great European experiment. We've seen that at an EU level. So if you look at the EU law, market integration, of course, is one of the key tenets of the law. Companies are established in different jurisdictions. Corporate governance does have that resonance, which you can see from its tradition, from the country of origin, but we are seeing increasing divergence across the EU. Why? One of the reasons Justice Hogan mentioned was costs, a need to reduce costs, to make it easier to cross borders. And if you have a look at the latest company law package, which was introduced by the Commission in April, they mentioned the importance of doing that, the importance of forging what they call a deeper internal market. But there's also the idea that the UK has more experience in the areas I've mentioned, it's beyond doubt, and they have been more innovative in that way. So the question is, will that innovation continue? And that depends on whether the law is likely to continue along a plan of harmonisation or not. Chetan suggested that the EU was particularly influential because it had a first mover advantage. So all other jurisdictions trying to develop their capital markets look to see, well, what worked in the UK? If we introduce investor protection laws like this, will this be attractive to investors? So it was an opportunity to reap the same benefits that the that the UK was seen to reap. And that certainly has been the case in a number of jurisdictions. There's a number of national laws which are very similar. Then we come to the idea of the impact of the UK around the table, the negotiating table, and it's very clear that the UK has played a role. We all know the role they've played at the legislative table, but again, I would like to emphasise the role they have played at the advisory table. So, to give you one example of that, ESMA working groups. So the Securities Authority, which looks after capital markets in the in Europe, there's advisory groups, and they're comprised of members of each of the jurisdictions. So, for example, if you look at the Takeover Bids Network, you will see that there's a UK representative there, and their advice has been hugely important. In driving not just the implementation of the existing directive, but also suggesting new policy directions and drafting guidelines. Is that likely to continue? To a large extent, it's going to be a question of trust. It's going to depend on the eligibility of the membership requirements. That may not be problematic. It doesn't always say that you have to be an EU national to be a member of these groups. It just says that you have to represent, in many cases, you have to represent an EU body. So what's to stop an EU national with this experience and this expertise representing an EU body? Nothing, I would suggest. Looking then at what will change. So greater or lesser harmonisation. So that's the big question. A number of people suggest that less harmonisation would be better, particularly in the area of corporate governance. The suggestion is we don't really want sort of watered down compromise provisions, something that has been reached because it's so anodyne that everybody could agree with it. By contrast, a bottom-up approach, it's argued, in this area of corporate governance is much more beneficial. On the other hand, there's the impetus to reduce costs in cross-border transactions. Academics have suggested that might be a little overrated. Yes, there's a question of reducing costs, but you are also balancing that with a loss of flexibility and a loss of innovation. UK innovation might decline. A lack of regulatory competition, some people say, will cause that to happen. The UK might be challenged in its role as the leading centre for commercial litigation. If Patrick has his way, that's quite likely. So does that mean that there are going to be less innovations for us to look to, less body of law? Certainly the UK lawyers don't believe that that's a major threat. Again, that's an issue that perhaps warrants further discussion. The UK won't have a place at the legislative table. The Chief Justice speaking at Fordham earlier this year, Justice Clark said that there's been a recognition of the role of common law, of the need to accommodate a common law tradition, and he says, well, there's no reason that would change. And that's correct. But what he also observed is it really depends on good people at the table, able to identify the problems and negotiate the solutions. is that going to continue? Yes, we will be at the table. Yes, to an extent, you can rely on Malta and Cyprus, but not to the same influential impact. And also, the resources are just not there. The number of advisory groups and relevant legislative bodies in which the UK sit, Ireland are just not going to be able to do that to the same extent. So they will have an influence in advisory committees. There will be codes, there will be agreements, model statements of best practice which work their way into EU law. And we've seen that already, and there is absolutely no reason why British expertise shouldn't sit on those boards. So one example of that is a group I'm involved with, which is called the European Model Companies Act, which after 10 years of working together with EU company law academics, put together sort of an EU equivalent of the commercial code in the States. So a model company that could be used in any jurisdiction or in all jurisdictions. There were two very prominent UK professors, Paul Davies and Brenda Hannigan, working on those. And you can see the influence, their influence, in some of those provisions. Is that relevant? Is that just an academic body? No, some of those provisions have found their way to the table. So one of the provisions was a suggestion as to group interest. That was at the Commission negotiating table in the last 2 years. So it is possible to find ways other than that. Are academics more open? I'm not sure. I thought I would finish with just reading out to you two lines from an editorial in the German Law Journal just before the vote on Brexit and talking about the possible implications of Brexit. They said, the editors of the German Law Journal consider that English common law tradition is a cherished part of Europe's socio-legal heritage. The European project and our life in the law will be the poorer should this week's referendum lead to a Brexit. We know firsthand how the encounters between English law and the different legal cultures found on the continent enliven and exhilarate and exasperate comparative and transnational law projects. Thank you.